From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Questions about gender are a big part of the zeitgeist. They're incredibly prominent for us right now and really charged. We can get bogged down, though, in our own moment and lose sight of the very long and winding history of this idea and the not-so-long history of the word gender itself.
Someone who's been mapping the history of gender in our world is Professor Sarah Williams from Regent College in Vancouver. We spoke to her about that history to get a larger perspective on some of the ways that we think about sex and gender today, and to see how that might reframe some of the fights that we've been having about it as a culture.
We started our conversation by asking her about the origins of our understanding of what is meant by male and female.
I've worked hard to trace back the meaning of the word gender first to 1963. And looked at why the word gender was introduced into the vocabulary. And from there, moved back to the 1790s. And my work has really heightened the fact that our modern ideas of masculinity and femininity are very rooted in that period when modernity is taking shape, the early 19th century.
Yeah, and in what sense? Like, in what way is it shaped by that?
There's a huge shift that takes place in the early 19th century away from hierarchical understandings of men and women, where a woman needed a man in order to be complete as a rational entity, which is very much a feature of the way the 18th century understood women. And the key change that happens in the very early 19th century is a new definition of what it means to be female. And that resituates both masculinity and femininity in the debate, specifically an emphasis on the importance of the home in civil society and the role of women as educators in the home, not just as child producers, but also as child rearers. And in the wake of the French Revolution and the turmoil of the French Revolution, a wave of thinkers emerge who want to emphasise the stability of society. And during that period, the home becomes a fulcrum for that.
So what happened in 1963 with this coining of the word gender? Mm-hmm. What was that coined for?
It was introduced in order to create language to distinguish sex as a biological category from gender as a set of traits or expectations that surround what it means to be male and female. And folks like Samuel Stoler, who introduces the word first, but also some of the 1960s feminist scholars, desiring to really unhook ideas about cultural conditioning from biological determinism. And so the word gender was really important. It was a huge intellectual step forward when it was possible to nuance the conversation and to introduce more sophisticated ways of thinking about how male and female are formed through cultural conditioning.
We often hear talk now of gender being a social construct, of being mm-hmm. socially constructed, whether that's entirely or partially. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, mm-hmm. that idea?
And I think tracing the history of the word gender helps us with that. So during the 1990s, in the academy, certainly, the word sex and the word gender begin to be used interchangeably. However, in this last 10 years, what we actually find is the word gender has replaced the word sex. So a chap called David Haig, who's a biologist at Harvard, did a study of 400 million academic articles from 1945 to the present, where he tracked the word sex and gender. And his argument really is that actually we have now lost the language for talking about any form of biological determinism. So gender has replaced the word sex, which is interestingly ironic, given the fact that it was introduced to create the possibility of nuance. Now replacing it might mean we need to find some other language to talk about male-female difference.
What does that mean for the idea of gender fluidity?
Mm-hmm. It is a complicated question, and it has loads of different kinds of answers. So one is the way in which in an extreme consumerist society, we have commodified selves. So we acquire self through the acquisition of various different kinds of symbolic tokens that we buy and we construct and we image. And so some of the gender fluidity language is developing in relation to those extreme manifestations of late capitalism. But that's not the only route. So another way of putting it is that today we understand gender as ultimately an arbitrary category that is constructed, that is chosen, that is fluid and multiform. And that closely relates to our understanding of how identities are created in the postmodern paradigm.
Do you think there's something about gender that is not constructed? And I suppose I'm using the word gender here in the way that we use it now. We conflate
yes.
sex and gender.
Yes. I think as a feminist myself, then it is problematic to me that we get rid of the word sex altogether. The idea that there is some biological difference between male and female, to collapse all understandings of gender into that one word makes it more difficult, I think, to talk seriously and carefully about gender fluidity, for example. So the arguments that are beginning to enter into the debate around transgender issues, for example, are very difficult to talk about without nuanced language. Mm-hmm. Talking about the difference between a gender orientation, a gender identity. If we get rid of the word sex altogether, then we're having a very different kind of debate.
So is it possible to talk about male and female differences, for instance, without suggesting that one is superior to the other?
Ideally, yes. I think in practice, in culture, often designations of difference, whatever they may be, are also very highly correlated to power and who gets to be in charge of defining a narrative. So male and female, I think, are absolutely integral categories in understanding the very nature of society, which is the idea of social unity with diversity. Without diversity collapsed and without uniformity. So those categories of male and female are really important for understanding the political sphere and the civil sphere. So I don't want to get rid of them as categories. And yet the reality of history demonstrates to us, I think, that often we use language as tool for power and control, and certainly male and female have been one facet of that.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
Right in the beginning of the Bible, in the creation story, it says, "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." But in our conversation with Sarah Williams, we discovered that the Bible actually has a lot more than that to say about gender.
I think because the Bible is a history book, it's an old text, we tend to think of it as a conservative text. We often associate it with traditional views, but we forget just how radical the Bible is, the way in which male and female configured through out the Old Testament, but also into the New Testament. The idea, for example, which early 19th century evangelicals pick up on, of the equality of male and female, it is only possible to talk about that in relation to biblical ideas of equality. So one of the most important legacies of Christianity in our culture is the introduction of the idea that men and women are actually equal. Both bear equally the image of God.
Does it take till the 19th century, though, for this to come out when these are thousands of years old, these ideas?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, there are many times in the history of the church when there has been a rediscovery of what it means to be male and female in relation to one another. I'll give one example of that. We talk a lot in our culture about consent. We understand sexual ethics in relation to the consent of the individual over the private property of their body. The idea of consent is actually championed by the Catholic Church in the 11th and 12th centuries, when monastic communities, interestingly, turned around and said to Carolingian culture, for example, it is not okay for a woman to be effectively sold to a husband without the giving of her consent. So the introduction into marriage vows of the woman's own voice, "I do," that itself comes out of a renaissance, a re-understanding of Christian theology in the 11th and 12th centuries. And because that is so natural to our way of thinking about the world, we forget how extraordinarily radical that idea is. It's totally countercultural to the kind of Greco-Roman world in which you are born into a state of inferiority or superiority, and the male operates in that superior sphere and the woman in the inferior sphere. And so sexuality itself is a power relation in which the odds are very much stacked against the woman.
This history is not well known. I mean, so much of what you're saying is news to me.
Yes.
I think you've done some work on suffragism and women's rights, the early women's rights movement, and women getting the vote. Mm-hmm. What role did Christian faith play in that, if any?
The feminist movement, as it develops in the 1960s and from the 1960s, has a particular philosophical underpinning. And that strand of historiography, the writing and interpreting of history, has emphasized female agency and emphasized the way in which the women renegotiated the public sphere. What has happened within that narrative is an association between Christianity and a sort of unrelating patriarchal mindset. And so somehow, somewhere along the line, Christianity's been written out of the feminist narrative. And often women in the women's movement, for example, women like Josephine Butler, who argued very strongly from a Christian perspective, it was essential for the woman to have the vote, using Christian theology as the basis of her political philosophy. The sort of late modern feminist doesn't quite know what to do with the combination of Christianity being a radical force for women rather than merely a subjugating force for women. And as a Christian feminist myself, it matters a lot to me that we actually recover that history, whether or not we are Christians. It's part of the history of feminism.
Well, Sarah, a lot of these questions about gender and marriage and family have become very controversial in our time. They're very emotive topics and very political topics in some way. Are there ways for people to disagree well on these kinds of issues?
Yeah, I think the debate around, for example, same-sex attraction has become fraught with argument and conflict. And I think that history is, I'm a historian, so I would think this, but history is fundamentally about listening to those who are different from us, who understand the world in different ways, use different languages. So I think there's an important part for history to play in setting a table for a conversation which is about listening. But I think the prior conversation that needs to happen is a conversation about loneliness. Sociologists are now beginning to say that the biggest single social problem in our culture is endemic, epidemic loneliness, that on a scale that we've never really understood. And it's a loneliness that people experience not only from place and family, but also increasingly from self. As self is mediated through technology, we've almost dematerialized the self such that the interior and the exterior are separate from one another. It's phenomenology. And so people experience loneliness in just this deep way that is profound and goes right to the root of people's personhood. And until we're having a conversation about that, I'd rather not be having a conversation about whether or not gay marriage is right.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. If you like this conversation with Sarah Williams, we've got plenty more like it. Visit our website, publicchristianity.org, or search Life and Faith wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe.
Next week, we take a look at what happens when countries try to get rid of religion altogether.
You know, I worked in two countries where in one country my faith was illegal, completely illegal, Saudi Arabia. Country right beside it, United Arab Emirates, it was legal and even encouraged. In one, I lost all motivation for work. In the other, you know, I wanted to contribute to society. So where faith is restricted for people, that makes them start to question, you know, does this society even want me? Do they value me?